listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. Begin with a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. We've been covering since it began in April an attempted coup in Nicaragua, strongly backed by the U.S. government. Over the past weeks, it's become clear that that attempted coup has failed. And for more on that, we spoke with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, based in Nicaragua, via Skype Monday. Okay, so it seems the story is actually finally turning here, and the truth is coming out about what has happened in Nicaragua, and that the government has the situation pretty much in hand at this point, along with, I would say more so, being led by the people who also have made their mind up about what's going to happen, and it ain't the color revolution.
Right. Yeah, and in the regional context, what's happening in Nicaragua is probably of the first importance, and obviously I live here and I'm going to think that, aren't I? But and if you look at it in regional terms, and the United States has failed to overthrow the government in Venezuela. They thought they'd have a walkover last year, and they didn't. They failed abysmally.
Yep.
And Nicolas Maduro, the president of Venezuela, and his government team, although they face very, very serious economic difficulties as a result of the United States' economic boycott and sanctions, and it looks as though they're steadily working towards a viable way of maintaining the Venezuelan economy in defense of the basic economic and social rights of the impoverished majority, certainly in Venezuela. Having failed there, the United States must have looked around and thought, well, Nicaragua's very dependent on Venezuela. They're now not getting as much support from Venezuela as they used to. If we destabilize them, they should be easy pickings. That's what they must have thought.
Yep.
In the State Department. and in Miami among the terrorist mafia led by Marco Rubio and Ileana Rosaletinen.
Right.
They must have thought that. They must have thought, well, Nicaragua should be easy pickings. And they started earlier this year, they started trying to take advantage of a fire in the ecological reserve, the Indian Maíz, which is a kind of biosphere reserve, a very important ecological resource in Central America, not just Central America, but all of the Americas. And they tried to set up a campaign around that. And as the usual suspects in the international media tried to stoke that campaign, The Guardian, The New York Times, claiming that the government perhaps had even started the fire and wasn't taking serious measures to combat it and so on, which is all complete falsehoods, of course.
And kind of cute when you consider, like, California has been on fire for about 5-10 years now. An awful lot of indigenous land, an awful lot of small farmers and others completely suffering huge losses, and not a peep about any of that. They treat it instead like a spectacle with heroic firemen.
So, right. Yeah. Yeah, well, in the case of the Indio Maíz fire, the government did invite foreign support from the Honduran Air Force and the Salvadoran Air Force, and they helped with helicopters that were specially designed to helicopters and airplanes that were specially designed to try and put out fires. And despite all the propaganda to the contrary, the Nicaraguan government does enjoy good institutional relations with the United States authorities, and they invited experts from the United States to help them combat the fire.
And they're working with El Salvador and Honduras is also newsworthy, actually, because it shows the importance of these, you know, of this resource, basically, you know, containing the fire, that it's something that's trans-ideological.
Oh, yeah, no, very much so. And Costa Rica also offered to help, but they didn't have the resources. They only had land-based firefighters who were unable to reach the fire.
Right.
Or the most important part of the fire. So, and the Costa Rican authorities and the Nicaraguan authorities agreed that the Costa Rican fire service wouldn't try and take part because they wouldn't be able to be very effective. But that was portrayed by The Guardian in particular and by The New York Times, as I remember, as Nicaragua rejecting help from Costa Rica.
Right.
You know, and that just completely twisting things around.
Right.
But anyway, and back then, whenever it was, when was it? February, something like that. Here in Nicaragua, everyone was benefited by the onset of rains in that part of Nicaragua, and the rains helped the firefighters get the fire under control, which
very
they
lucky,
did successfully.
Yeah, very lucky.
And in the end, despite the false claims of the opposition media, only about 0.3% of the Indio Maíz Reserve was actually destroyed by the fire. And the authorities here reckon that they'll be able to make that good within a few years. So anyway, and that happened, and then because they were unable to take advantage of that, they must have already set up the infrastructure that they needed for the coup by preparing the logistics of how they would carry out their attacks once the coup got going.
Right.
They must have got all that prepared back then when there was the controversy around the Indio Maíz fire. And when the government, very maladroitly, it has to be said, tried to implement a reform of the social security system that actually defended workers' and pensioners' rights. And it actually extended the rights of pensioners to better health care. But asked them for a 5% levy to help finance it. And the pensioners' organizations here in Nicaragua agreed to that. But of course, that never got reported.
Right.
It was all just reported quite falsely as a neoliberal austerity measure.
Yeah.
When in fact, the people who would have had to pay the bulk of the increase were going to be the business classes. And that's why they walked out of the talks around that issue, precipitating the government's decision to go ahead with the reform regardless.
You know, that's one of the things anyway, because the people in the United States are ignorant of so much. And, you know, not I'm not going to place the blame on my fellow Americans, but rather on the institutions here that intentionally do this. But anyone that has any understanding of how the Sandinista government and the Sandinista party relates to the constituency, to the people, basically, would understand that this plan that was implemented was the result of an awful lot of information from the bottom up, an exchange and a conversation that went on with the people before they acted. Sure. That's the normal way they operate.
Yeah, I think that there was consultation around what the priorities were, but there wasn't adequate consultation about how to implement the measure.
Physically, right. That's a bureaucratic... That's the thing that you generally make as a decision at the bureaucratic level, and unfortunately, that is where, in general, government tends to bungle.
Right. Well, that was certainly the case here. Anyway, and so then, despite people thinking they know what happened, and what's extraordinary about the relentless media onslaught in North America and Western Europe in particular against the Nicaraguan government, what's so extraordinary is that they leave out really fundamental facts about what has happened. Because if you read the North American media or the Western European media, the impression is that all the deaths that resulted from the attacks were the fault of the government, that the government started the violence by repressing peaceful demonstrations, and that subsequently the government has been completely intransigent, refusing to recognize the legitimate demands of the opposition, and that the brave, peaceful protesters throughout Nicaragua are now suffering a crackdown on their peaceful protests by the sinister, repressive government of the dictator Daniel Ortega. That's the narrative. But in fact, for example, what was the first big lie? The first big lie, just as in Libya and Syria and elsewhere, was that the Nicaraguan government is massacring its own people. That was the first big lie. On April the 18th, social media reported a massacre of peacefully protesting students. Mm. In fact, nobody died on Wednesday the 18th. Mm. Subsequently, on April the 19th, the Thursday, three people died, and not one of them was a protester. So, and where did that the government's massacring its people come from? It was just a pure invention, right? So, yeah. And then subsequently, Daniel Ortega proposed dialogue around the social security reform, which was supposed to be the reason for the protests. And suddenly, oh no, that's not what we want. We want Daniel out. The demand shifted almost overnight from protests around the social security reform, which were entirely bogus, and the people protesting could hardly care less about what the social security reform, what they wanted right from the start, and subsequently came out in the first few days, was regime change. And they demanded that, and the right from the start, the protests were extremely violent. Attacks on municipal authority buildings across the country. What's that got to do with social security reform?
Right.
You know, and none of it was peaceful. And we've spoken in the past about the extreme level of violence in the country, and now that we've got to a point where the protests have petered out, and the police are back on the streets after having been withdrawn,
right,
as a precondition for the dialogue. There's so many aspects to this. We probably couldn't cover it even if we talked about it for 4 or 5 programs.
But there's a couple things worth parsing in that little point there, okay? First of all, you know, this demand for the resignation of Ortega and of his government that comes, about 18 months after he was elected, re-elected, Ortega, with 72% of the vote, okay? So there has been no catastrophic change in the economic situation in Nicaragua, even though the United States has been feverishly since then attempting to pass what it calls the NICA law, which would isolate the banking system, try to throw the finance sector into chaos, try to deny some basic goods from ending up on the shelves in Nicaragua, et cetera, et cetera. Despite that, that hasn't had really any impact yet at all. There's been no other real change in the conditions of people's lives there in terms of a negative. In terms of the attempt to provoke a government response and make a claim like they did in Libya, for example, that the government is murdering the citizens, or like they did in Syria and they do elsewhere, when you get a couple of right-wing snipers shooting people at protests and blaming the government. When Ortega pulled the police out, what's happened is the situation became stabilized by the people themselves. In other words, peace has come on the ground because the people secured it for themselves.
Well, yeah, and I think there's a lot of truth to that point of view. But one of the important things to understand is that there was a lot of momentum that generated by the social media campaign and the blanket. And another of the big lies is there's no freedom of expression and there's no free media in Nicaragua, you know, which is right. Just a pathetic joke.
Insane.
Because at least half the media are controlled by the opposition.
Yeah, the most powerful media, almost. I mean, the entire corporate media, in essence, is the opposition. So.
Well. And that's not entirely true because the government has 3 or 4 very influential TV channels. But right. and I think it's in the Nicaraguan context, it's a mistake to put too much importance on the power of the main opposition media. The two big newspapers are owned by the opposition. Important TV channels, Canal 10, Canal 21, Canal 15, Canal 12, channel, the 100% news or 100% lies, they call it here. It's called the 100% news channel, but here people call it the 100% lies channel. but the importance of those media is not so much that they control people's perceptions directly, but that they feed into a network of local radio and local cable TV channels, right? And that was what, in my opinion, it was that mechanism, the feeding of the big lies from the most powerful Nicaraguan media right. into the extremely malleable local radio news and cable TV news networks. For example, here in Esteli, there's a Cable Televisión, and that's owned by somebody loyal to the political opposition here. But and a lot of people in Esteli follow that channel, that cable TV channel, and that's true in every city across Nicaragua. So they already had their network set up in order to feed their poison and their disinformation and their downright lies into the minds of the majority of people in Nicaragua, and for the first week, 2 weeks, maybe even 3 weeks, and people were fooled by that. But very quickly, the thing here is that people here in Nicaragua live often from day to day. The people at in the popular economy, they depend on income from one day to the next or 1 week to the next. And very few people are able to say that they've got savings that will enable them to survive 2 or 3 months of economic hardship. That's not the case in Nicaragua.
Right.
So when the opposition generated crisis especially the roadblocks that they set up to intimidate people and prevent normal economic life. As the effects of the opposition attack on Nicaragua's normal social and economic life developed, very, very quickly, ordinary people in Nicaragua started to be affected. And that's where your observation comes in about ordinary people in Nicaragua defeating the coup.
Right.
Now, that's not entirely true in the sense that people rose up against the people operating the roadblocks directly.
Right.
And that they, in places they did, here in Esteli they did. And that's how the roadblock here in Esteli was defeated. But and the government, in order to restore normality, rather than sending out the police or even... And one thing to note is, if this had happened in El Salvador, Honduras or Guatemala, the first thing the government would have done would have declared a state of siege and imposed martial law.
Right.
But that didn't happen here. And that's one right. of the reasons why the death toll was so high, because the government didn't call out the army, and possibly leading to a situation where even more loss of life took place. They relied on the resilience of the people to resist the worst effects of the coup, and they tried to negotiate where they could negotiate with the opposition, and where they couldn't negotiate with the opposition, they did send in the police. The most serious example of that was in Masaya, in the area of Monimbo of Masaya, which was taken over by delinquent gangs. And I've got a friend there and his wife. You know, I didn't know very well before the crisis, but I was in constant touch with them through the crisis. And their reading of what happened in Masaya is very, very different, the complete opposite of what you read in the mainstream media.
Right.
And the nitty-gritty is that the government has managed to defeat the coup, disperse the delinquents who are operating the roadblocks, and that's another lie. For example, the mainstream media say the students that were at the head of the protests, that was true maybe for a week, at the most 2 weeks, but subsequent to that, the violent intimidation, the incidences of torture, of people often at the roadblocks, the phenomenon of the Catholic Church harboring these delinquents in their churches, harboring their weapons, and allowing their churches to be used as centers of torture, Don. There's videos all over the internet.
I've heard that.
People being tortured in churches here in Nicaragua.
It's just so amazing.
Right? So, and the mainstream media, of course, cover all that up. They cover up the fact that over 60 schools were attacked and damaged during the course of the crisis. They cover up the fact that 22 police were murdered and 400 police suffered gunshot injuries. Mm. Right? Now, what would happen in the United States with that level of violence against the police? Do you think that the army wouldn't be called out? Of course they would.
Oh, please. Just the threat that wasn't necessarily even made by them, but the threat that hung out in the culture of Black Panthers, defending the community by killing the pigs, that enabled... raids on Black Panthers, where they would, come in and shoot machine guns into an apartment, and then go inside and see, who did they turn into Swiss cheese, like Fred Hampton and others. And that wasn't based on the Panthers actually doing anything to.
Of course, you're still in the United States. You're still living the legacy of that with figures like Mumia Abu-Jamal and many others.
Or Tamir Rice, a 6-year-old kid or whatever who happens to have a water pistol outside and gets shot to death.
Right. So, and of course, in the United States, that reality is completely misrepresented. And so we shouldn't be surprised that the reality in Nicaragua is completely misrepresented.
Right.
But that level of violence also completely changed public opinion over the course of the 3 months of the crisis. And while the for now the coup has been defeated internally, and how do we know it's been defeated? Because there's just massive popular rejection of the coup mongers, massive popular support for the government. And the last week was July the 19th, the anniversary of the 39th anniversary of the Nicaraguan Revolution back in 1979 that overthrew the dictatorship. And that's another thread that you come across constantly in the mainstream media, the comparison with Daniel Ortega, between Daniel Ortega and Anastasio Somoza, as if there's any comparison at all. It's just completely insidious and sinister and absurd in the most unjust way. But for example, on July 19th, the BBC, instead of covering the hundreds of thousands of people that packed Managua's Plaza de la Fe, the faith plaza, here and all the way up the main boulevard in Managua that runs down to the lake, that's called the boulevard from Chavez to Bolivar. Instead of covering that massive outpouring of support for the government, the BBC on their website ran an absurd comparison between Daniel Ortega and Anastasio Somoza. And then at the same time on the 19th, because of the threat of opposition violence attacking people that would have traveled normally, there'd be huge caravans of people traveling down to Managua from all the rural areas of the country. But this year they decided not to do that because it was too dangerous because of the opposition violence and the threat of ambushes of people, as happened on May 30th when a caravana from here, from Esteli and points north, was ambushed by opposition gunmen. That wasn't reported by the mainstream media. One Sandinista supporter was killed, and over 20 people were wounded and had to be taken to hospital by opposition gunmen, these supposed peaceful protesting students.
Right.
You know, just a complete lie. So anyway, instead of those normal caravans traveling down to Managua for the 19th, they held local municipal celebrations of the 39th anniversary of the revolution. And there too, there was massive support in all the main urban centers, León, Matagalpa, Hinotega, Ocotal, Esteli, Huigalpa, and all those places, and over on the Caribbean coast for the anniversary. But none of that was reported, of course not. And then nor was there any reporting of the pathetic turnout on Saturday the 21st by the opposition, who at the start of the protests were able to mobilize around 30,000 or maybe even more people on their marches in Managua. But on July the 21st, they barely managed to get together a march of 1,000 people. Damn. So the popular support for the opposition has collapsed and may even be lower than the levels that they enjoyed before the crisis, which, right, you know, electorally they have about 30 to 35% in elections.
Right.
But their core support is down around between 10 and 20%.
I mean, there's a logic to that, because people that suffered through the last few months, as it became clear exactly what was happening, you know, you have the same phenomenon that you saw in Venezuela when the right became so emboldened that they attacked the Supreme Court by smashing a helicopter into it, or whatever the hell it was, the aircraft that they did. Now, can I ask you something about the mediascape there? I know that the Sandinistas, from the beginning, I mean, we're going back to even before 1979, really, in the areas that they were able to secure, encouraged and trained people in literacy. They taught the people to read. And there was a heavy emphasis on this as a part of integrating people into, you know, public and political life as well. And so the newspapers play a larger role there than they do in some other countries where, you know, people are, you know, not, you know, first world industrial powers. There is it still La Prensa, El Nuevo Diario, and Baticana that are the main newspapers?
Yeah, Barricada folded way back in the early 1990s.
That's gone. Okay. So you have La Prensa is kind of the opposition newspaper, and El Nuevo Diario.
It's the business newspaper, and El Nuevo Diario are the business. La Prensa is basically a fiefdom of the Chamorro family.
Right.
Carlos Fernando Chamorro is a very influential journalist, won prizes from the Columbia School of Journalism, which tells you a lot about what he is. Mm. You know, and United States journalism is a joke, as we can see from their coverage of just about any foreign news crisis.
Right.
But he and his media group are basically an NGO. He runs an outfit called Confidencial, and another NGO called Cinco that promotes media training. And those are heavily funded by the National Endowment for Democracy and other United States foundations, as is the Chamorro Foundation that belongs to the Chamorro family. And you have to remember that the Chamorros are an oligarchic family.
Right.
And from way back. And there's even a treaty called the Chamorro-Bryan Treaty, whereby a forebear of Carlos Fernando and Juan Sebastian and all the rest of the Chamorros gave away Nicaragua's sovereignty in a treaty agreeing with the United States not to allow a canal to be built without the permission of the United States.
Right.
That's way back, 1907, 1908.
1914, yeah.
So that's what the Chamorros are. So anyway, look, the key things that I should have stated are that although the coup has been defeated, the violent provocations are very likely to continue because they need them to fuel the campaign at an international level that will facilitate a sanctions regime against Nicaragua, very similar to the one that they've instituted against Venezuela and the one that they've maintained against Cuba for over 50 years.
Yeah, I mean, I would just point out, and I'm piling on to that particular point, that when the coup was defeated in April of 2002, certainly the efforts to take down Venezuela did not end. They continue till today, and that's the way they're going to play until Washington itself collapses. Thank you very much, Tony, for a very interesting discussion, and we'll speak with you again next week.
Okay, thanks a million, Don.
Thank you. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Worlds Apart. Even for those who've seen war up close, the conflict in Syria set a new benchmark for cruelty, callousness, and impunity. More than any other war, it capitalized on the public's repulsion of violence and produced death and suffering not only as an inevitable result of hostilities, but also deliberately for political and media effect. Can these kinds of crimes be ever adjudicated in a court of law? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Catherine Marquis-Ruel, head of the UN International Impartial and Independent Mechanism on Investigation and Prosecution of Persons responsible for the most serious crimes under international law committed in Syria since March 2011. Madame Marquis-Ruel, it's great talking to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Now, I've been interviewing people in positions of power for quite some time, but I have to say this is the longest title I've ever come across, 21 words, not counting articles and prepositions, all to express the idea that this is not exactly the tribunal, but it may lead to one. Is that accurate?
What is accurate is that it's not a tribunal, and it is indeed to assist in the investigation and prosecution of those crimes and of the person that may be found responsible for it. But as it is not a tribunal, indeed, this mechanism has only a sense if it can turn its files or its evidence to tribunals.
Now, you call it impartial and independent, despite the fact that the key actors in the Syrian war, like the Syrian Arab Republic or Russia, don't even recognize the legitimacy of this mechanism. Don't you think that these terms, impartial, independent, require the support of everybody in order to be applicable?
There are extremely important terms in the title. I don't call it. It was named this way by the General Assembly, which decided to adopt, establish this mechanism. 105 states voted in favor of this mechanism, but indeed 15, including Russia and the Syrian Arab Republic, decided to vote against, and they have explained reasons why they do that. 52 states decided to abstain. So if the question is whether that those modalities of adoption actually render this mechanism less legitimate, or whether it's impossible for us to be independent and impartial, my answer is no. I think being independent and impartial is not just terms in the name of the mechanism. That are principles that I, but also my entire team, are extremely committed to. That's the legitimacy of our war.
But when you speak about impartiality, the United States was one of the driving forces behind the creation of this mechanism. And the American ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley, specifically stated that she sees the IIIM as a valuable tool to, quote, hold the Assad regime accountable for the atrocities, including its repeated and ongoing use of chemical weapons. Now, I understand that that may sound as impartial in Washington, maybe even in Geneva, but certainly not in Moscow or in Damascus. Is that a misunderstanding or perhaps a misrepresentation of the mandate?
Maybe I shall explain what it means to us in the mechanism, being impartial and independent. I would start with independence. Independence means that you're not going to take instruction from any of the states. And we know that in the situation of Syria, states have agendas. So not taking instruction, not acting according to agendas. What does it mean? It means that you are doing your work professionally. You are seeking to receive information from a variety of sources, not just certain sources. What does it mean being impartial? It means that you are showing, genuinely, but also showing no bias in favor or against any of the states.
I understand what you're saying. You're talking about your methods of work, but there are also other considerations that come into that, and one of that is funding. You are funded so far on the voluntary basis, and when one of your main sponsors comes out and states the purpose for this mechanism in very stark geopolitical terms, I wonder why would you expect, for example, the Syrian state to cooperate with you in good faith?
I cannot speak for the states. The states are taking their responsibility when they speak. What I can say is that whether a state is currently under voluntary contribution funding our mechanism or not, this will not lead to any change of attitude on our side as to how we conduct our work. What I would like the Syrian Arab Republic representative to understand, and that's what I've tried to convey to them, and any of the victims from whichever side they may be, is that the mandate that was given to us is broad. It's not targeting one particular side to this conflict. It is broad. It is focusing on identifying, investigating first, and building files concerning the most serious crimes.
Your title refers to the most serious crimes, and
yes,
you know, seriousness is like beauty, it's in the eye of the beholder. Why was this particular formulation chosen as opposed to, let's say, crimes against humanity or war crimes, which come with their own well-defined legal standard?
If my recollection is correct, the same terminology, if you wish, was used in previous accountability mechanism, and now I'm thinking more of tribunal, which we are not. But really, there is no ambiguity as to what crimes we're talking about. We're talking about the most serious crimes under international criminal law, which are indeed, as you stated, war crimes, crime against humanity, genocide. But even under that category, in fact, when you look at the variety of allegations, the scale of atrocities, you must be extremely modest as to the capacity to investigate all of that, selecting and showing in your selection that you are actually doing what you say you do, which is to look across the board and not focusing or targeting only one side is extremely important.
Well, let me follow up on that, because the countries that endorsed the creation of this mechanism includes some countries which supported insurgency, often foreign insurgency in Syria, by covert and overt means, without officially declaring war on Syria, and oftentimes in contradiction with their own domestic legislation. Theoretically speaking, does this fall under the IIIM's definition of serious crimes? Is that something that you intend to look into?
I will look at it maybe slightly differently, and maybe explain to you the methodology, because I think that explains it all. We could have decided to collect, I would say, information or evidence on the basis of what's easier to collect, or we could, as we have, chose a methodology that was going to be apt at giving us a capacity to answer the very questions that one has to answer when looking at crimes against humanity, war crimes, or genocide. So what we decided to do is to actually undertake what I will call here for your audience a structural investigation. And let me explain what that means. You start identifying the overarching question that you have to put yourself in terms of patterns of crimes, in terms of contextual elements that you will need to be able to establish those facts. You try to answer questions such as, can I identify recurrent crimes? Can
exactly.
I identify structures of power?
Closer to my to my question. Are you going to apply that structural analysis to the nature of the Syrian war?
We are going to apply that structure to the entirety of the situation to try to identify indeed those entities, structure of power involved.
Structures of power only in Syria or beyond that?
We're going to look at what can be relevant to establishing liability. So when you look at liability, you look indeed at two broad, I don't want to use particularly legal term, but two broad categories. Command structures, on the one hand, that would be relevant for command responsibility. You also look at actions which may qualify as assisting, fueling, facilitating the commission of crimes.
I'm not a legal expert, and it's difficult for me to, you know, draw a conclusion from what you just said, but do I understand that the response to my question would actually be yes, that you will not only be looking in Syria, but beyond Syria as to who have contributed to that war?
We can look at what indeed can be a means which would entail liability, criminal responsibility for the crime, and that's not the physical perpetrator of the crime. That goes beyond that, including those who aid the commission of a crime.
You know, as I was preparing for this interview, I devoted some time to studying the materials of the Nuremberg trials, mm-hmm. which dealt a lot with the issue of the war of aggression, and which the chief U.S. prosecutor at the time, Robert Jackson, defined in his opening address as the provision of support to the armed bands formed in the territory of another state, and which, according to him and many of his colleagues at the Nuremberg trials, was the biggest crime of all, because it allowed all the other crimes that happened on that territory to happen. Do you think this kind of logic, this kind of rationale, should be applied to the Syrian war?
What I think is that we should concentrate on conduct that can qualify as war crimes, crime against humanity, and genocide, and indeed look genuinely and broadly enough as to the various conduct that can attach responsibility for those crimes. You're talking about the crime of aggression.
Yes. Supporting terrorism or supporting armed groups on the territory of another state.
I'm actually looking at the crime that I describe at the moment. That's really the focus of our focus. But that includes conduct that could facilitate the commission of crimes. You've referred to financing certain groups that are involved in the commission of crimes.
Weapons, something. Some countries are
these kind of
talking about that publicly.
These kind of conducts fall part of what a structural investigation and a criminal investigation looks at, indeed, yes.
Part of your mandate is also to, as you said, to assess the evidence and the strength of the evidence, to contextualize this that evidence. And I assume that in order to do that, you will have to define the war in Syria first, whether it was a war of aggression, a war of defense, a civil war. How do you contextualize your evidence? What's the framework for
that? I think the question's really relevant to, for instance, war crimes, because that's one of the crimes. For crimes against humanity, you don't need to qualify the conflict, in fact, legally. But for war crimes, identifying whether there was a conflict or several conflicts and what nature of those conflicts is needed.
Do you think those terms could be manipulated? Because if you just define everything... No, but because this is a very relevant question, because an air raid on a civilian neighborhood may be considered as a crime against humanity, but if you put it within the framework of war, and when you know that, for example, that neighborhood was attacked because there are terrorists there who have been attacking other neighborhoods and who've been using it as a base, if that changes the framework, doesn't
you're it? You're asking me whether it can be manipulated. That's not the way I see it. The way I see it is those categories of elements or material elements of crime that are well defined by law, by jurisprudence. So I think we are in relatively safe areas there. Then, of course, the act of analyzing whether the evidence that you collect is sufficient to conclude on each of these elements of crime, that's...
But are you going to consider those nuances?
But we are going to consider to apply a criminal law methodology to, first of all, assess whether the evidence we collect is credible and relevant, obviously, but also credible. So when you ask whether some manipulation can, of course, arise in the context of producing evidence or fake evidence or manipulated evidence. So it's a classic, recurrent and very familiar technique of being very cautious with what is presented to you as a piece of evidence, and you have techniques to deal with that. It depends on the nature of the evidence in question. A very careful and scrupulous scrutiny of a testimony, for instance, is a way. But if you're dealing with evidence in the form of videos, for instance, or you look at different aspects, when you look at documents, you need to look for authenticity, and there are techniques to do that.
Madame Marquis, I have to stop you for a second. We need to take a very short break, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Welcome back to World Apart with Catherine Marquis-Uriel, head of the UN Authorized Mechanism for the Investigation and Assessment of Evidence of Crimes Committed in Syria since March 2011. Madam Marquis-Uriel, this mechanism was created by the UN General Assembly in the final days of the Barack Obama's administration. It was less than a month before the inauguration of Donald Trump. Has this change of power in the United States affected the development of this body in any way?
I don't think so. The General Assembly gave us this mandate. The Secretary General shortly thereafter appointed, requested assistance from the High Commissioner for Human Rights to appoint a startup team. The Secretary General defined very quickly the terms of reference, and then we started operating shortly after my nomination. So I don't think the politics in the U.S. or elsewhere have really affected the development of the mechanism.
As far as I know, as of late May this year, the Trump administration was still holding up the funding for the mechanism. And according to the Washington Post, they may be wrong, but this is what I'm using as a source, that hold on funding may be indefinite. How critical is the American contributions to the functioning of this entity?
Well, not more critical than any other state. As you know, we addressed it a little earlier, the fact that we are currently in a situation of a voluntary contribution. That in itself, honestly, I don't see as an issue of potentially affecting our independence, because as I explained,
Sustainability, you need to plan
ahead. Sustainability, you're totally right, Oksana. We are vulnerable if we can't sustain our funding. And that's why it's so important that the General Assembly last December 2017, called upon the Secretary General to include the funding needs of the AAAM within the next budget, so that's the budget for 2020. That's important for us because you will understand, I know you realize the importance of the task that is upon us. We need to be able to concentrate all of our efforts on doing our job.
If I'm not wrong, the operational cost for the mechanism's first year was estimated at around $13 million per year, which includes salaries and UN-mandated privileges for roughly 50 staff members. Is that how much this entity is expected to cost in the coming years, or are you expecting some fluctuations?
In 2018, so 13 million was the estimation that was made before even my appointment. There were some aspects of the funding that were identified in the report of the Secretary General, so it's not that those issues were not taken into account, but it was just simply not possible at the time to have an estimate of how much it would cost. So those costs were not included in those 13 million. I'll give you one very notable example. The cost of securing the evidence and of dealing with, in the particular context of Syria, an unprecedented amount of video material. I mean, if you want to do this work properly, you really need to store safely, securely, very large amount of evidence. You can't just decide to go for a little part, because, I mean, that would question your impartiality as well. We now know that the cost of only that is approximately a little more than 2 million per year. The exact amount of money that we need for 2018 is 14 million, and I expect the budget that we will seek to obtain to be over that.
I interviewed the UN Secretary General just a few weeks ago, and he was very open about a lot of cost cutting and cost optimization that he and his colleagues have to do at this point of time, especially due to the decrease in the American contributions. Do you have any concerns that this mechanism is going to be downsized even before it had a chance to develop fully?
Well, I'm an optimistic person, so I don't want to consider that. What I will say seriously is that there are certain areas where you can't compromise. So safety, security, capacity to collect, it would be, I mean, this mechanism has really the potential of becoming a comprehensive central repository of the evidence. So for the Syrian situation, we need to do that very seriously and broadly enough to be able to do our job. If we were to incur costs, that would have an impact, I would say, on the capacity to run simultaneously a certain number of cases. And I hope I have explained to you, we really want to be able to run cases at the same time and not to decide, okay, let's focus now on the government or on Daesh or on other groups. Let's
or on the foreign funders of those groups.
We want indeed to be able to do our job at a pace which demonstrates this willingness of being impartial and independent. Not being able to proceed at a decent pace is not good for many reasons. First of all, the trust that you are trying to build will be very difficult to build, including from the communities in Syria. And by communities in Syria, it's communities of victims. I'm extremely conscious that we're talking about very different group of people. They don't live the same situation. They are having different expectation or maybe different level of trust vis-a-vis
To be honest with you, having spent some time there, I don't think anyone is expecting justice there, especially from the international community. But that is just a side note. Let me ask you specifically about the assessment of evidence, because during your recent press conference, you said that you're not going to take for granted any previous conclusions. You're going to go back to the drawing board, identify the gaps, and use your investigative mandate to fill those gaps by applying a criminal law standard.
Yes.
Why is that necessary, and why wouldn't you trust all the previous conclusions?
Well, it's not so much a question of trust, I would say. Let me explain to you, and maybe it's an opportunity to explain, for instance, the difference of mandates and functioning of the Commission of Inquiry and our mechanism. a fact-finding body, be it a human rights fact-finding body or another fact-finding body, apply a legal standard when they reach conclusions, which is not a criminal law standard. It's not a fault of them. It's due to their mandate.
Just to make it clear for our audience, a criminal law standard is a much more stringent
standard. It's more stringent, yes. You may be able to reach conclusions that a certain pattern of crime existed or that certain violation existed without using that quite stringent standard that criminal courts in democratic situations apply. And the level of standard that we have to apply, even though we are not a court, if we want our work to be relevant to a court, is that criminal law standard. It's methodologies. We were talking earlier about how do you decide whether a piece of evidence is actually credible and reliable. It's corroboration, not being vulnerable in building a case by relying only on the a tiny piece of evidence to establish a very important fact. You want to make sure that you have enough evidence to meet those standards. Of course, it's for courts to decide.
What is becoming increasingly more common in international practice is the blurring of lines between prosecutorial and court functions. And I know that your mandate includes, for example, the investigation of the chemical or alleged chemical weapons attacks, something that supposedly falls under the mandate of the Organization for Prohibition of Chemical Weapons. And I'm sure you know that they've recently been given functions of determining who is actually responsible for the crime. Don't you find that troubling as far as your work is concerned? Because you are obviously committed to the creation or the prosecution of those evidence in a normal court of law. Mm-hmm. Don't you think that the work of the OPCW would essentially make that kind of tribunal unnecessary?
Well, honestly, really, not at all. I explain you why. I think we are talking a fact. If you take the fact-finding mission of the OPCW, they are looking at evidence to determine according to their standard, which again is lower than...
But this is not a legal standard. This is a scientific standard. They are trying to use scientific evidence and all power to them.
But courts sometimes use scientific evidence to determine certain facts. So let's try to unfold this particular example. What they do is that they determine based on evidence, including scientific expertise, to determine whether chemicals were used, chemical weapons or chemical used as weapons. What the previous body, joint body between OPCW and UN, the joint investigative mechanism that no longer exists, was doing until November last year, was doing a second layer, looking at whether these attacks that the fact-finding mission determined to amount to use of chemicals could be attributed to an entity or another.
Absolutely. And Russia, for example, voted against that mechanism specifically because it thought that it was manipulated for political reasons.
So what the OPCW is now being given late June in a recent decision is to, if my recollection is correct, the Secretariat is to make arrangements to allow the...
That's exactly my question. Why do you think those functions should be given to a body whose objectivity is sometimes doubted by its own members, rather than, let's say, an organization, an entity like yours, which insists on its impartiality and which is proficient and professional in applying a legal standard?
Let me explain you why. Because we serve two totally different purposes. One is to make reports, public reports, as to, on one hand, existence of instances of the like, and on the other end, attributions. They don't use the same standard. They make public reports.
But if they make an attribution before you take a case to court, do you seriously believe that this is not going to prejudge the outcome?
But we apply a different method. We apply criminal law method.
So we will have different kinds of adjudication mechanism. What for? Why would the public have to spend its money
My team is not making its conclusion public. Well, not even, although we report to the General Assembly.
You're supposed to prepare cases for courts.
Exactly. And that's why I started by telling you, or you were quoting my report and saying, You are not going to endorse conclusion. Yes, it's true. Well, it's not a matter of trust. We apply different methodology. So we are. What's very important for us is to get access to the underlying material. So that we don't have to reinvent the wheel in collecting things that already is there. We will assess this material, applying the criminal law standard. We will see whether there are gaps in the evidence to actually reach a conclusion.
You would do that already after a certain international body came out and accused
but it doesn't, but it doesn't matter.
Well, it does matter if you wanted to ensure the cooperation of the Syrian side, for example. But Madam Mercurial, we have to leave it there. I really appreciate your being with us today. And I encourage our viewers to keep this conversation going in our social media pages and hope to see you again. Same place, same time, here on Worlds Apart.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.